I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I hope you guys are okay, enjoying the Euros. We're on a couple of rest days here as I record this just before the round of 16 kicks off. So we will be interesting to see if by the next time I speak to you if England and Wales are still in or if we're out. Sorry to Scotland who are already going home, but at least it wasn't too far this time.
Yes, but spare a thought for those plucky losers. Bad luck, Scotland.
Don't come home too soon. Sorry, boys, you did again. Anyway, great episode for you today. We've got Roger Sargent, who's a photographer. You will know his work. Some amazing shots he took of Oasis over the years. And yeah, really interesting discussion about Oasis and the Libertines and about photography and getting into music industry and apartheid and getting hold of records in South Africa in the 1980s. Yeah, it's a good one. It's a wide-ranging one. And yeah, and make sure you check out the details in the description of this episode for the upcoming Libertines exhibition, because that sounds really, really interesting. And yeah, and I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. Before we get on to that, Noel has still been doing the rounds, promoting Back the Way We Came, which went to number one. Which was his, 175th number one album in a row, apparently. So, yeah, well done, Noel. Really impressive. I think, as we might have talked about on here before, we were discussing whether or not we thought it would get to number one. And I suppose what we found here really is the power of the double attack of, you know, the nerds that are really into vinyl and will go out and buy it on vinyl or buy it on CD, and the collectors, that side of it. And obviously we know physical, you know, does tend to give it a push up the charts. And then you've also got the I call it the Beautiful South factor. If you remember, the Beautiful South's albums did okay, but then when the Best Of came out carrying up the charts, it did brilliantly. I think it was like one of the best-selling albums of the 90s. And and the idea there was that, you know, a lot of people, Beautiful South probably weren't their favourite bands. They might have, you know, not too bothered about getting the individual albums, but Best Of, fantastic. And I think maybe there's a bit of that with Noel, that maybe Oasis fans or people who have liked Noel over the years, but not enough to get the individual albums, have gone, oh, Best Of, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll give that a listen or I'll pick that up. So I think there's a bit of that as well. But anyway, however he's managed it, and he's number one in the album charts, which is a massive achievement, really, for what you would call a heritage artist, and not even based on his most successful group, on his kind of follow-up solo group. So yeah, very impressive. I've given the album a listen a few times. You know, for me, it's interesting to hear the other songs, the, you know, songs we know, sort of mixed up in a different order and things. That's fine, but I mean, I listen to Spotify on shuffle a lot of the time anyway, so it doesn't really make a big difference to me hearing songs in a slightly different order. There are a few new songs. I'll put new in inverted commas. The one truly new song is International Magic Demo, which, as we talked about on the, I think, the show with Richard, where we were saying, well, International Magic, that's the name of the DVD. Well, yeah, it turns out there is a song called that. And it's the instrumental I played a little bit of there before I started chatting on, which is cool. It's fine. It's got an interesting kind of vocal effect, which feels to me so like it's more like the sort of the 2000s period. It's got a feel of like almost Little James around it. So whether it is from then or whether it's from a more recent, I don't think that's been officially confirmed yet. In the million interviews that Noel's done, no one's actually asked him any actual interesting questions along those lines. There's been a couple of other interesting tunes on there. I was on the Britpop Revival show this week, and I was saying on there that Nick sort of reached out and said that we're going to make that the album of the week. Do you want to pick four songs and come on and have a chat about it? And the four songs I picked, one of them was the Skeleton Key remix of This Is The Place. And basically, yeah, the choral is effectively Skeleton Key, and they've remixed two of the tunes. This Is The Place, my favourite of the two. And really, they've just wiped all of the Noel song and just re-recorded it themselves, and then with Noel's vocal on top, and I think it's much better. So yeah, so that's definitely worth a listen. If you're the sort of person that's like, oh, remixes, not even going to bother, that is definitely worth a listen. And what else have we got on there? We've got there's a few like acoustic versions, but it feels to me like it's not that they've actually sort of re-recorded, or this was an early demo that was then, you know, redone in the studio or something. These feel to me like just they've taken the original recordings, and it's almost a remix again, but it's almost like an acoustic remix. So yeah, I don't think they're that great, to be honest. I think all the songs, if they had, I don't know, been sort of an acoustic demo like Dead in the Water, really stripped down style, I think they could have been quite interesting. But with the, you know, the way they've been put together, yeah, they're fine. They're nice enough to listen to, but they don't really jump out at me. So as I say, Noel has done a load of interviews. To be honest, I haven't kept up with all of them, because I found a lot of them to be very, very samey. Probably the best one he did was with Apple Music. That was like a quite long, in-depth one. Went actually into the music and into quite a few different subjects as well. So let's have a little bit of that.
I was trying to think, well, when did Noel's solo actually start? I was trying to pinpoint it. And I came down to the breakup statement that you put out the morning after Paris in 2009. Because what that signified is the end of Oasis. There's no going back after that. Mm. And it makes it worldwide and everybody knows it.
Yeah.
And I think you signed that off by saying something like, I'll see you down the road somewhere. Yeah. So we know that something's coming next. I don't think anyone's really asked you about it.
I didn't write it.
You didn't write it?
No. I was in such a fury, and I, you know, it's a really stressful time, and being the way that I am, was prepared to walk away and say nothing. And my management was saying, you cannot say nothing to your fans. And I was like, there's nothing to say. It's done. And I got on a flight and went to the south of France, and then Sarah and the kids came over. And by the time they'd got there, they said, well, can you sign off on this?
And I was like, who wrote it?
Yeah, someone in my office wrote it.
It sounds like you.
Well, they know how I, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I couldn't, if I was to sit and write that statement, it would have been enormously long. And I was just in such a, no, I'm done. I've walked away and that's it.
All right. Couple of shout outs. We get into the interview with Roger. Check out a unboxing video that a patron who you've heard of on here a few times, Andy Middleton's done. He's just managed to get hold of one of these limited edition Noel Gallagher Gibson guitars. And he did an unboxing video on that, which was very entertaining. So I'll link that in the description of the episode. And also a massive shout out to Adrian Connerboy. Now, if you remember, Adrian was the guy that we did the episode about 3 years ago now, where he got brain cancer. He got brain cancer, and it was sort of singing along to Oasis songs and talking along to Oasis songs that really managed him to kind of learn to talk again, you know, and it was such an interesting story. Anyway, his charity is called We Can Kick It, and he provides like football coaching for families with cancer. And he's just got an MBE. Amazing in the recent sort of Queen's birthday list. So massive achievement. I'm sure that's going to do, you know, really, really helpful for the charity. So well done, Adrian. And finally, yeah, James Hargreaves. This was interesting. if you guys heard my radio show on Barrow House Radio that I did last time, I played a clip of James Hargreaves' tune from his EP. He's the guy that James Hargreaves' guitar's done stuff on here, and he does stuff on YouTube. Loads of really good Oasis videos, as well as a lot of good other stuff. And he put together this EP, It's Good to Be Back EP. And and he actually went into the charts. He went to, like, number 5 in the physical charts. Amazing, incredible achievement. And it just shows that you can do it. So, inspired by him and inspired by Bits and Pieces, I've been thinking about doing something as like a physical release. And I wasn't sure whether to just, you know, do something and just print it up myself and send it out to patrons. But, you know, I think we could go the extra hog and get something in the charts. My idea is like a compilation CD of like Northern Soul, you know, where they dig into these like unheard tracks and, you know, these things that were only limited releases or demos and things. And you know, and then they compile them and put them out as a compilation. I think that you could do that for Britpop. You know, like the tune Shine On that plays at the start of the episode is one that my band recorded. And if it wasn't for the fact that I played sort of 20 odd seconds of it every episode, no one would ever hear it. And yet, I think it's really good. And I think there's loads of great music out there that was probably recorded and is just sitting on dusty old CDs in people's back bedrooms or in their mum's garages or whatever. So, you know, I'm thinking about putting a CD compilation together of those sort of tunes. So if you were around in a band in the 90s and you think, oh, that'd be cool, I'd love to be featured on a compilation like that, then give me a shout. And it's not definite at the moment, but I think we might be able to do something. But anyway, we shall see. Right, enough of my yakking. Without any further Freddy ado, let's speak to Roger Sargent. So welcome to the Oasis podcast, Roger Sargent. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
No worries at all. And you said that you're sat by a nice window with birds tweeting in the background, sunshine here on a sunny June. Quite nice in England sometimes, isn't it?
It can be. I think that, you know, everyone's already started moaning about it being too hot, though, having spent about 8 weeks moaning that it was too cold. So yeah, it's life in Great Britain, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's how it is. But whereabouts are you and whereabouts did you grow up?
I'm in a little place called Henlow, which is in Bedfordshire. Nearest place you may have heard of is probably Hitchin.
Yeah.
I don't come from here. I was born in London but kind of grew up in the Midlands and then South Africa. My mum married an awful lot of people, so we moved around a lot. So I kind of grew up a bit like an army child, but without being in the army.
Got you. An awful lot of people. Was she a Mormon or something?
No, I think just indecisive.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough. But that must have been quite interesting, and especially going to South Africa as well. In when would that have been? 70s, 80s?
80s, yeah, I was there. Basically, I got there the year that the state of emergency was declared, which was, you know, when they brought in all the curfews during apartheid and stuff. So it was a pretty volcanic place to be and a pretty, I guess, influential for me politically, because being out there, one tends to identify with being British, or at least you did at the time, because aside from black people, the sort of Afrikaners hated British people almost as much as they did black people, basically. So let me just wait for that to go past. Sorry, there's a guy who's got a fucking Harley Davidson who lives just around the corner from me. So you know, I'm not trying to by any means put my plight up there with the with the indigenous people, but it was it wasn't a pleasant place to be, put it like that. And so music and sort of my own cultural identity was really important, because it kind of gave you something to look forward to. Everybody just wanted to get back to the UK and go and see bands, and you couldn't get records out there, really. You know, people, you know, that thing, you have one guy who had like the Smiths record or whatever, and then he would just bootleg that for dozens of people. And the same with the Jam and stuff like that. So that was the sort of stuff I was listening to, and quite a lot of punk rock as well, Crass and Conflict and stuff like that.
Wow. So how come you couldn't get records out there?
Because there was an embargo. You weren't allowed to sell, like, no record labels would sell out there. So everything had to be brought in on import, in a sort of grey market sense. You know, understandably, they were boycotting the country, but it made it, if anything, it kind of had a backwards effect. It just made the Afrikaners, you know, the white Dutch descendants, kind of double down on their agenda, because they felt even more marginalised. And if back at the time, you know, if left leaning music and culture had got in there a bit more, things might have changed a bit earlier.
I remember, I know when, like, it was Queen, wasn't they? They played like
Sun City,
yeah, and got a load of crap for that and stuff, didn't they? And it was
understandably, because that Sun City was the embodiment of everything that was wrong about the place. So to go and play there, I remember it's a bit of a random one. I'm not sure any of your maybe some of your listeners will know what I'm talking about, but I don't know if you remember a comedian called Marty Kane.
Yeah, yeah.
She played Sun City randomly, and that was the kind of stuff that it must have been a good payday. That's the only thing I can think.
Out of all the superstars that have come to South Africa, you probably attracted the most attention. How do you feel about this?
Oh, great! I shall tell Rod Stewart when I see him next.
Well, you sell more than Rod Stewart in South Africa, isn't that so?
Yes, sir. It's wonderful, isn't it?
Did you know that you had so many fans in South Africa?
Well, we had some idea of our popularity here, but we didn't realise it was quite that.
Anything you'd like to say to your South African fans?
Yeah, we hope you get real excited, and because we're pretty excited to be here.
Going to the concert?
Yeah, definitely.
What have you heard about them?
I've heard it's a great show.
What are you expecting at the concert?
Oh, something fantastic. I've heard it's been the most fantastic show ever.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's not too dissimilar now, I suppose, to a lot of performers that will go and do Saudi Arabia, you know, and things like that. And actually then they get picked up on, well, you know, should you be going out there with the human rights and all that sort of stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people talk about the cancel culture nowadays, but it definitely existed back then with things like that. But if anything, it's kind of more understandable back then. It's like the cricket team that went out there, and the England cricket team went out there, and they weren't allowed to be picked for 5 years or something afterwards. So I mean, I used to buy. Well, no, that's a lie. I didn't buy. I used to borrow other people's NMEs, and occasionally buy it, because I'm not kidding. Like, to buy a copy of NME out there was the equivalent of like 3 weeks pocket money.
Really?
It was like spending, if it was in today's terms, it would be like spending sort of £30 on a magazine.
Wow. That's nuts, isn't it? And so was it, as well as the music, I suppose, you know, obviously knowing now that you going into being a photographer, I suppose I remember back to getting the NME, and you'd read about bands and you'd see the pictures of bands before you'd even heard them, because, you know, obviously pre-internet, I'm, you know, a bit younger than you, but I'm 10 years younger than you. But even then in the 90s, it would only be if you happened to catch them on the evening session, you know, whereas actually, you know, I'd be reading about these bands, and I was just flicking through some of your pictures. Like, there's Camp Bag Vela Set. I remember seeing those images of Camp Bag Vela Set in the NME or Melody Maker, maybe before I'd even heard them, you know. And so I've got, so that was that. I suppose it would have been even more extreme than that for you in South Africa. But, you know, seeing these images and probably having very little chance of hearing the music.
Well, that was the thing. You know, we occasionally you'd get people who'd gone on holiday back to the UK, and they'd bring back like 4 weeks of Top of the Pops recorded on VHS cassettes, which would then get bootlegged and sent around to people. And that was it. You know, it was either the NME, because Melody Maker you couldn't buy. So it's either the enemy and then these sort of weird tapes that would get sent around. And that was the only way you could really get to discover music. And because of that, I think I still think we're missing that kind of critical view of music. You know, it's all a little bit aggregated now, and bands become famous because of likes and listens rather than of, you know, because they've got anything great about them. Yeah. I really miss that. I really miss having that kind of Bible sort of thing that you can go to, where you get people who you trust their opinion. You know, when I came back to the UK, I used to read a magazine called Underground, which was a bit more kind of left to center than NME even was. But there were journalists there that I would trust their opinion. I would go out and buy a record the next week, you know, just on the strength of what they said. And then, to a great extent, the NME as well. But now it's just about lowest common denominator, and I think there needs to be more, you know, more opinionated people, basically, I think.
Yeah, this is interesting, isn't it? Because I think as well, because with social media as well, I think that everyone's being very nice, but then there's also like that complete hatred as well. And I don't think the likes of Stephen Wells and people like that were just, you know, so aggressive and mean and rude to bands, I don't think they get away with it anymore, because, you know, because then the band would then be upset about it, and it'd be like, and they'd play the mental health card. And so maybe you can't get away with being that. And that some of that writing was incredible, visceral, exciting writing. Fucking rude, but actually at least it was interesting writing. And if someone needed to be eviscerated, actually, you know, is that a bad thing if they then went away and up their game and made better music?
But see, there lies the problem. It's, you know, obviously the bands are important, but it can't all be led about, you know, the sort of taste or the collective taste can't be led by whether you upset people or not. And, you know, if someone screams, you know, the emperor's got no clothes on, then you shouldn't be afraid to say so. And that's what's missing. You know, it's like, well, does he like it? If he likes it, then I must like it. And she likes it, and so do I. There need to be people sticking their heads above the parapets and saying, you know, the emperor is naked.
Mm, no, absolutely. So, well, where are we then? So you're in South Africa, you're getting hold of these things and you're seeing the images. I mean, what was the, in both in terms of music and also, you know, photography and art and things, what was really piquing your interest around them?
Music, it was... Everything was a bit delayed out there. So we were listening to Style Council and stuff like that when, you know, about a year after records had come out, just because of the delay, literally. So there was a lot of that, a lot of punk rock music and just this kind of desire to get home and start, well, you know, what we called home and start a life, which I did when I was just turning 18. Cool. And sort of got back to the UK in, yeah, sort of 88, 87, something like that. And it turned out not to be the kind of place that I'd been fantasizing about. And I think we were in a bit of a, certainly culturally, we were in a bit of a lull, and financially it was, you know, not quite recession, but it definitely wasn't a boom time.
Got ya.
And so I went to college. I ended up doing photography because it was in the middle of winter and it meant we didn't have to go outside. It was like an elective thing that you could do instead of doing like canoeing or something, you could do photography. So I chose that and found that it was a really good way to get into the local venue. I was in Derby, by the Derbyshire by this time. And there was a really good venue called The Dial that we used to go to quite a lot. And I found that if I gave pictures to the promoter, he'd get me in the following week, you know.
Oh, great. So
it was a great place to see bands. And around that time, it was just when like Ride and Lush and Primal Scream and Teenage Fan Club were very much on the up. So it was quite an exciting little scene going on. You could see bands weekly, like really good bands every week.
No, absolutely. And I suppose you're going in with a camera, and when not many people actually had cameras, you know, whereas now every bugger's got a camera with filters and everything attached to it, you know.
Yeah. And yeah, no, I was probably the only person shooting every week.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but was that an issue, like getting in, or once you've sort of started giving the, you know, because I remember some venues are really funny about cameras back in the day.
Well, that was the thing, because I knew the promoter, the promoter ran the security. There was no problem. There was never a problem. I could pretty much do what I wanted, so long as I didn't upset the bands. And I would always make a point of speaking to the bands before the show and just saying, is it all right if I do some pictures? And then occasionally I'd get to shoot them afterwards as well, or, you know, do a little group shot. I managed to do it with Ride and Teenage Fan Club. Not very good pictures in retrospect, but it was all a learning curve, you know.
That's great. And when was it, when you were sort of starting taking those pictures, was there a particular kind of inspiration for you in the photography side, or were you just trying to kind of, you know, bring out what you wanted to try and achieve with these photos?
It was it was more the latter, really. There's only so many ways you can take a live picture of a band, so just trying to get clean, well-framed, well-executed pictures was really the most challenging thing. It really piqued my interest of, you know, feeling like I was documenting something really important, even back then. That was the buzz for me, just feeling like I was part of something that I'd only read about before, even just as a little, you know, sixth form student in Derbyshire.
Mm. No, absolutely. Well, once you're, especially I suppose having been away and these people being literally thousands of miles away, and now these people who you'd only ever seen in magazines and papers before, you're sitting down in front of, and that must have been quite a shock.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And how were Ride? Do you remember how they were? Because they seem, I mean, I know that they weren't I've interviewed Andy for here, and I know that they were not known for being the most exuberant and excited to be doing sort of media stuff at the time.
I think that I honestly believe that like bands behave a little bit differently when they go to the more regional places, and they're quite, even though they were selling out venues, they were quite pleased to have people locally show an interest, even if it was something they knew wouldn't actually get published or anything like that. I think most bands I've encountered were really encouraging. And Ride definitely were, you know, they were happy to do, you know, it was only like 2 minutes, you know, just a little group shot against a wall. But they were happy to do it, you know.
And that's cool.
And I think, I think a lot of the people you come across kind of have the idea that you might cross paths again.
Got you. Yeah, good shout. When, I remember reading, I forget what I've read and what people have told me in interviews and stuff.
Yeah. But
when I remember reading an interview where with a magazine editor, where they're saying, especially when you're looking to get covers, magazine covers, we're jumping ahead a bit here, but it's, you know, just thinking about sort of setting up when you've got four people, you know, and it's often like, even then with the Oasis side of it as well, you know, really for a striking image, you want Liam. Or Liam and Noel, but then with bands, there's often that thing of, well, no, we need all five. And I know it's then when you're trying to frame up a magazine cover or a newspaper cover, it then becomes like a just this mess of heads. I mean, did you get much pushback from that, saying, guys, can you just all shift out? Can we just do a picture of the handsome lead singer, please?
It's the perennial political problem with shooting bands. I believe Penny Smith, won't shoot bands of more than four people. Full stop. She won't do sessions with bands more than four people because of that very reason. All you've got to do is throw height problems in as well, and you've got a very untidy looking picture. You know, I'm proud to say I shot the what's now known as the worst Oasis cover for NME. And I say that with full knowledge that it wasn't down to me. It was down to what they were wearing. And that's the thing, you know, when you've got, if you've got three people and, you know, you've got more control over what people are doing and stuff. When you've got five people and they're like a kind of gang and they look kind of oddly shaped, you know, like the way they're standing and all that sort of stuff, it's much harder. And if they refuse to take off certain items of clothing and, you know, like hats and stuff, then it just gets worse and worse. So yeah, it's obviously it's much easier shooting one or two people, and I think when the picture looks too busy because you've got all these disparate aspects to it, then it's harder for people to engage with it.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's funny when you've got, I know, like the small faces only got big when they dropped, what is it, Jimmy Winston, the original keyboard player, yeah. And they're saying it's because he was like 5'8" or something, and the rest of the guys were all like 5'4". And so once they got McLagan in, you've got them all, they're exactly the same height, and the look was so much better. It's similar like with the Beatles as well. Like, you know, they were all pretty much the same height, pretty much the same look, and you could just line them up and it would just aesthetically was pleasing. You know what I mean? When you've got, I suppose, yeah, it must be difficult. Like when Andy Bell joined Oasis, for instance, then you've got someone who's like 6 foot. I mean, Andy must be, what, 6'4" or something. He's tall guy, and the rest of them all pretty you know, all like 5'7" to 5'10" or whatever.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, what was the Oasis cover that was the NME worst cover or whatever? I don't,
it was Noel said it was his least, he said it's the worst picture that he's ever seen of a band, and he was gracious enough to say that it was because of what they were wearing. It was I think album three, or it might have been Be Here Now, I can't remember. I think it was for Be Here Now. It was basically Liam and Noel at the front wearing what I can only describe as sort of fisherman hats and kaggles, and they just looked terrible. They'd never consider ever wearing anything like that now, do you know what I mean? And there's some stuff from back in the day I know Liam's really proud of wearing, you know, even like the old M&S jumper and stuff like that. He'll happily go, yeah. But I think both of them will agree they look fucking terrible in those pictures.
Well, speaking about that, you've got a shot. I know you posted it online recently and it got quite a bit of traction of Liam on stage at Glastonbury, wearing that M&S jumper. I think it was Patsy Kensit's jumper, I think, wasn't it? And you've got, that's a beautiful shot.
Oh, no, God, no, that jumper's from way before. That, I don't think he'd even met Patsy by that stage. Have you seen the picture I did in the Splash Club in the Water Rats?
Yes, yeah.
It's the same jumper, because I used to wear them as well. They were like a cotton M&S jumper. And for a reasonable price, you could kind of look half decent. And I think, you know, they didn't have a lot of money back then, but it was just something that kind of transferred. Because that Water Rat shot was only, God, I don't know, a matter of months anyway, before that Glastonbury show.
Yeah.
So, because I remember speaking to Noel at the side of the stage, and I'd been on stage all day because it was the NME stage. And I'd been photographing all the other bands. It was an amazing day because you had like Radiohead, Pulp, Oasis, Blur. It was incredible. It felt like something was happening, you know. But I remember, so I'd been on the stage already, and then when Oasis came on, it was middle of the afternoon and it was fucking rammed with people. And I just said to Noel, "You're a bit nervous, have you seen the crowd?" And he said to me something like, "No, I'm not nervous about that. I'm some more nervous that the single's just gone in at number 11. So it was a real pivotal moment around that time for them. I think they'd only had Supersonic out, and then it was Shaker Maker or something, the second single, you probably know better. So it was, it might have even been Supersonic, I can't remember. do you have an encyclopedic knowledge of those?
Yeah, not too bad. But yeah, so when's Glastonbury? June.
Yeah, June 94. It
June 94. So yeah, so that would have been Shaker Maker, I think.
You're gonna wake up then, yeah. Yeah. Some real songs. It's a metal rattle on the drums.
But it was exciting, you know. I think up until then, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the Boo Radleys were the only band to have had a big hit, you know, from our bands, you know, from indie bands. So they were the first band to have quite a big hit with Wake Up. And then Oasis, you know, kind of kept sort of caught up and then, you know, left them in the dust. So, I mean, you know, I'd gone to see bands for two or three years before that and always expected the bands that I love to be, you know, to be playing small venues. And suddenly we had one band that we loved that were, you know, they were in uncharted territory for most of us, including themselves, you know, although they loved the Beatles and stuff, they, you know, for a band where the contemporaries were still playing to, you know, 2,000 people at the most, they were absolutely killing it.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? So just going back to that Water Rat shot, this is the one, and I'll put it, obviously, we'll post it when we post the episode, but it's that one where Liam's kind of bending over, holding the mic stand, staring direct into the camera. Is that what we
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, and like, is it the flash or something's glinting off the mic stand as well?
Yeah, I'm literally, just to get a tiny bit technical, that's shot on a 20mm lens, which is a really wide lens on a film camera. So I'm probably about a foot and a half from him, maybe less, very close to him anyway. And he's basically spent most of the gig just staring me out. It was an intimidation thing as much as anything else, which is why I kind of loved them from the minute I started shooting them. Because I love a bit of attitude. I love a bit of... And he even kind of, you know, gently shoulder barged me out of the way when he got off stage, which I thought was great as well. you know, because he was cocky as fuck, and that, you know, you want your rock and roll stars to have a bit of danger and a bit, you know, have something about them. And he's never changed. You know, he's lovely. I get on really well with him, but he's never changed that kind of way about him.
Yeah, I love it, and as I say, that's just what you want. That was why they were always, you know, and even now when you go and see him, it's so exciting seeing him because you just don't know what he's going to do. And I mean, even on the last tour, at the end of the show, he was just standing stock still. It was like the guitar feedback is sort of just going over. Everyone else left the stage. He was just stood there with his sort of with his hood pulled down on his anorak and just stood there for like 5 minutes. And everyone's just stood there like, what is he doing? And then he just sort of backed up, like laughed at us, like, you know, he's just winding us up and then left the stage. And you're like, who else would do that? You know, who else would just have the guts to do that? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So when was the first time you met them then? Would it have been that Water Rat show?
No, I didn't really meet them then. I was sort of like this, I had this weird in-house photographer gig at Creation. So I was on a retainer, just not, you know, photographing odd moments and stuff for them, you know, like when they signed bands and, you know, press shots for certain bands and all this sort of stuff. Didn't really include Oasis a lot, but because I had that in with the label and with Johnny, there, who was the band's PR, I'd get extra access. So they started pushing me towards doing Oasis more often than not. And I got on quite well with them from an early stage. So I would meet them, I think they probably met them after gigs at mostly, because I'd be with people they knew. So we just sort of get talking, I'd get snaps. So, you know, it was, I met like Liam and Noel on various occasions more than I met the other guys in the band. The first time I met all of them together was probably when we went to New York when they first played in America. And I got some really funny photos of Noel and Bonehead absolutely lashed after their first gig. And they ended up using one of the shots as the Creation Christmas card.
Okay.
Because it's just silly, you know, fucking about. So that was probably the first time I met all of them. And then shortly after that, I did the first cover. I did two or three covers for Enemy. I did more than that. God, I can't remember now. Probably about five Oasis covers for Enemy, but not all of them were sessions like those two. So the second one was, I can't remember the names of albums now. The one with the skyscrapers and stuff on the front.
Standing on the Shoulder of Giants.
That's the one. I did a, that was the last proper session I did with them, I think. Yeah, I mean, I did other covers which were mainly kind of live or just grabbed shots after gigs and stuff, but those were the two like proper sessions that I did.
Well, we actually sat them down and spent the actual time.
I managed to get that picture of Liam at Water Rats had been made into a poster by the Japanese record label, and they'd sent me a few copies of it, and it was the first time. It's the first time I ever got anything signed by a band. When I did that last session with the band, I got Liam and Noel to sign that picture, which irked Noel a little bit. But Liam said to me it's his favourite picture that he's ever had of him.
I've heard that. Yeah, that must be pretty cool. You know, he must be one of the most photographed people in the world. That photo that you took is his favourite.
That's amazing. Amazing.
Very cool, isn't it? And Tony's in the background as well. You should get Tony to sign it as well.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I have to find him first.
I know Tony. Oh, there you go. No problem at all. We can set that up. No worries.
I'd love to do that. I met him a couple of times. He was an absolute sweetheart. I always felt bad for the way he was treated.
Super Sun, I don't know it. Lawrence is here for the ride. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've got these. You may well have bought them as well. Just for fun, I got that. That's this company called Gnome and More Heroes made an Oasis set of garden gnomes.
Oh yes.
And poor old Tony's half buried in a hole. That's how the gnome is. You don't see his face. He's just sort of buried in a box.
Yeah. No, I love that. They've done well actually. Gnome and More Heroes. That's brilliant, isn't it? I've interviewed Tony a few times. I know him. He's a lovely guy. He loves it. Cool. So, well, that's really good. And so, and I know talking to when we had Jill Furmanowski on, who's obviously, you know, done tons with Oasis and done books with them. She was saying it was often like herding cats, really. You know, you're just trying to get, you know, especially because they weren't the most compliant and Liam being mischievous and things, that it's often just trying to grab them, you know, and it was such a nightmare.
I think her job was probably harder in a sense, because when you're a tour photographer with a band, even though you get on better than the other photographers, let's say, they kind of treat you more like family, so they ignore you more. So her job would have been harder by virtue of that. Whereas when they're doing like a cover session for a magazine, they're kind of on duty. So it's a bit easier. So even when she'll have been doing like a cover for Q, they would still treat her like a mate more than a photographer. You know, I've had it with bands like Libertines, you know, they're a nightmare to photograph at the best of times. But I see them then, you know, because we'll be on a press junket and they'll do like a session with me for whatever cover, and then they'll do a couple of others with other people, and they're like, why are you so fucking easy with them and you give me such a hard time? You know what I mean? It's the same reason. I mean, most of the time I've shot Oasis, like the both covers, they were, the only thing that was difficult with that first one is they refused to take the fucking hats off. But for that second session, they were brilliant. Really easy, yeah. really helpful. And,
but also, I suppose you would need to know and understand what...
Sorry, I just remembered the other time I shot. It wasn't really Oasis, it was Liam. Because I shot the Enemy's 50th anniversary cover, and it was Liam holding a picture of John Lennon. And he was amazing for that, because he just engaged so much because of what it was. You know, he was very proud to be on the 50th anniversary cover of NME, and also he got to hold a picture of John Lennon.
Yeah, I could imagine that would have been, yeah. That I mean, was that, whose idea was that?
Undoubtedly his.
That's nice, isn't it? Yeah. But yeah, it's...
I mean, that's the great thing, because of stuff that, even, you know, I'm not saying I'm anything like good mates, you know, we have a really good professional relationship, if you like. But because of that, when it came to doing that, he asked for me to do the photo rather than, you know, who was probably the guy that was probably getting more work than me, who was a bit more flavour of the month than me. He asked for me to do it rather than someone else, because it's ultimately, if you relax with somebody, you're going to get better stuff, and he knows that as much as anyone else.
Yeah, no, I've just got this photo in front of me, actually. Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? And Liam's just got that look. I mean, he's got the shades on, but they're not that, you know, they're not full-on shades where you can't see the eyes. I suppose you can still see his eyes. I mean, you said, mentioned about hats. Was that difficult trying to convince people, well, Oasis specifically, but then other bands as well, to get the shades off? Because shades make you look cool, but then I suppose you really want to see people's eyes. That's a big thing.
There's only certain bands that can get away with wearing shades, and they're bands that are iconic already. You know, also as a human being, you change as you get older and you get more confident in situations. You feel better about just calling people's bullshit out. You know, I'm not in the least bit intimidated by any band that I photograph now. Whereas back in the day, I would be a lot more intimidated and a lot less likely to, you know, to say, look, you look rubbish, let's change this up. Whereas now I'll happily say that.
Yeah.
In a nice way, but I'll happily say it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you all want the same result, don't you?
Exactly. And I know what makes people look good. So, you know, it's best just to cut to the quick and waste everybody's time much less.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so what about when you're sort of trying to get, do you almost have to, like, when it's more of those sort of fly on the wall and sort of, you know, not like the posed shots, but when you're just trying to get sort of the impromptu shots, is it, you know, is there a method behind that? You're almost trying to be sneaky, or how would you go about that?
I think there are two ways. If you don't know people very well, then you just try and blend into the wall. But if you know people really well, they don't tend to take much notice of you anyway. If they're comfortable around you, you can do pretty much anything, especially with bands. I mean, the one thing that that most bands will say about me is that they trust, they know that I'm not going to fuck them over. So I've been in lots of situations where I could have shot people with, you know, getting off with girlfriends or girls that shouldn't be there, or boys that shouldn't be there, or doing drugs or whatever. And over the years, I could have made a lot of money out of that, but I just never have, because I want to get asked back, you know? So that's the way, that, you know, it's integrity as much as anything else. That will make you disappear in a room.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Have you got some of those photos though? Could you ping them over?
Yeah, sure, sure. for a small fee.
Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks, set the night on fire. Wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love. But the tumors spread nasty disease around town. You cut on the houses with your trousers down. A head rush and in the bush. You know I cherish you, my love.
Well, speaking of rock and roll and taking drugs, obviously you're very well known as well for your work with the Libertines.
Yeah.
Who you've been, pretty much from, you know, from day one, pretty much. And you know, what jumps out to me is those iconic red jackets, you know. So how did you come to work with them?
I'd pretty much quit the music business, actually, and a friend of mine, and I'd moved out of London, and a friend of mine said, look, you've got to hear this band. It wasn't not because he thought this will change your life. He just wanted me to. He didn't want me to leave. He didn't want me to stop taking pictures. I just had enough, you know. So yeah, he said, "Look, come and see this band. I'm going to be working with them." And I he just said, "Come and see this gig." Anyway, and it was the best thing I've seen for years. And it was, you know, insane. You could see them doing drugs literally on stage. It was it kind of hit all the right notes for me, you know, cocky, exciting, dangerous, tick, tick, tick. And so then when I met them, I decided to move back to London, and I could see that this was going to be at least, you know, a year's work or so. And it turned out that a couple of years before we'd actually lived, you know, in the same apartment building. They lived above us. I lived with Stephen Wells at the time, and they were in the flat above us. And suddenly I remembered them being these kind of odd trench coat wearing kids going everywhere together and sticking demos to the door, which I now wish I'd kept instead of throwing away like we did.
Wow,
every time.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Because they knew Stephen Wells lived there, so they'd stick demos to the door all the time, which would then be thrown away.
How funny. I had no idea it was Stephen Wells. I mentioned Stephen Wells 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah.
That's nice.
It's a really good mate.
Yeah, that's crazy. And then so then you clocked it was them. But that's an amazing decision to move back to London or to stay in London just on the basis of thinking, well, this band is going to do something. That's a bold choice.
The problem, one of my many problems is that I'm probably too led by, you know, there needs to be a love going, you know, there needs to be a love of what I'm doing. This has never been like a job for me. I need to be able to love the band that I'm working with. Obviously, there are times where you do some gigs for money, and that's the only reason you're doing it. Generally, you have to love it. And when we had periods of time where the music was terrible, it just made me want to walk away. And that was one of those periods, you know, because it's hard on your mental health working in the music business, because you're only as good as your last gig. You wait around, you know, back in the day for the phone to ring or nowadays for emails to come through. You're constantly sort of checking yourself and, you know, am I doing this right? And all this sort of, you know. So for me anyway, having a band that I can build a relationship with and work with for a long time is much more fun than working at a magazine. And if it's a band that you love, then Christ, you know, it's rare that it happens. But that's what works for me.
Yeah.
I've never treated it like a job. Otherwise, you might as well just work at the post office.
Like you never seen the light. You're walking like it every night. But I've never seen you dance, and I've never heard you sing. So how could it be a single thing? This is a rudimentary.
Yeah, exactly. But when you were, I mean, so you were right there in London and sort of going back, taking it back a little bit. So you were sort of what, NME?
Yeah.
At that period in the, you know, in the peak really of the 90s. Did it feel like, oh, this is a period that we will talk about in 30 years, you know, like it has become?
Definitely. Yeah, it was, again, because I think, you know, if you take a step back, music in terms of quality goes in peaks and troughs, doesn't it? We have periods where you get, you know, some great bands that are influenced by possibly previous great bands and so on and so on. And it usually happens sort of every 10 or 15 years. And at that point, we just come through, no offence to these bands, but, you know, we'd come through like Ned's Atomic Dustbin and stuff like that. They were the big bands. And then suddenly we were getting bands that even, you know, we like Smash and these Animal Men, you could feel that something was happening, even though it didn't really transfer out of London. And then Blur put out Modern Life is Rubbish, which initially like they couldn't get any traction with, but then sort of swept everything along a little bit. Suede were knocking around as well, even though they would say that they weren't part of it, but it just felt like there was something going on. You know, we'd been in awe of American grunge music for so long, which I love, don't get me wrong, but it's great when you've got stuff happening on your doorstep as well. So yeah, it really did feel like there was something exciting going on.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, the readership was in hundreds of thousands at the time.
Yeah, it was the biggest time since punk, basically, for NME.
Yeah, and loads of incredible writers like Wells and I mean, yeah, just, I mean, how was that office? Because you get the impression it was pretty nuts, pretty rock and roll place to be as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was a weird time. Everybody, when I joined in 92, beginning of 93. No, sorry, beginning of 93 I started there because I was at Melody Maker first. Literally all the writers just left because Steve Sutherland got made editor and they all hated him. So literally everyone quit. So it was like a brand new team. So you had people like Paul Moody, Johnny Cigarettes, Mark Beaumont. They were all kids and they were just starting. So again, it felt like a new generation of writers and photographers as well. Do you know what I mean? So everything felt like you were part of a team. It was brilliant fun.
No, that's really cool. And so many of those, like you say, with Johnny, but what about like Stuart McConey and John Harris and all these other people that are now kind of...
Stuart had left, but Stuart was one of the people that had left.
Oh,
yeah. John Harris was another pivotal one. You know, we were all about the same age. You know, they were a bit older than me, most of them, but, you know, I was like 21, I think. They were sort of 23, 24. And when you're that age and that kind of like hungry, then yes, you will create scenes and make more out of something than there is possibly. So they, you know, they'll, whether or not they admit it, I'm sure they wouldn't mind me saying that, you know, they were very much pivotal in making Britpop happen. You know, because they lumped a bunch of bands that didn't want to really be lumped together. Mm.
See, I've got nothing wrong with that. I don't think there's anything Neither wrong with I. that at all. I love Neither having scenes. And I think that's part of the problem now is that, like, if they, no one's actually, if you look back every two or three years, there was a scene with a name, even if it was stupid, like, you know, the no-name scene or the scene that celebrates itself or whatever.
Yeah.
At least it was fun. New, you know, at least new you put a label on it.
New Wave with New Wave, that was another one. And even around the time of the Libertines, you know, you had like New Rave, and the Libertines, like, I don't know if they ever called it anything, but, you know, there were a slew of bands around that time as well. Guitar bands became really popular again. So it was like a mini resurgence of Britpop then for me.
Yeah. I think that kind of gets called like the New Rock Revival.
Okay.
I think that's probably like the Wikipedia genre for it.
But, you know, I'm the last person to be just harking on about the past in that respect, right? I mean, I think we should, you know, it's very important to look to the past and it's great to have influences and all that. But I'm the last person that will just get doe-eyed and reminiscing about stuff all the time because I still love new music. And But the problem is, we don't have, there are no people like that anymore that, you know, that will kickstart things, because there aren't any journalists that, you know, all the journalists with opinions were kind of culled from Enemy when it became basically a PR machine for bands.
Yeah.
You know, around just after Libertines and stuff, where, you know, basically they never slagged anyone off. They'd often just quote from press releases. You know, it was fluffy. And because of that, you need that opinion, you know. And then you've got, you know, what's the equivalent? You know, Instagram influencers, you know, YouTube channels, things like that. I think the only kind of cutting edge lies in podcasting, really.
Thanks very much.
But it's true.
I know. Well, it's podcasting, and it's this sort of underground stuff. But yeah, I mean, when you, I just get so frustrated. Like, you following the Enemy, and it's like, I'm just looked at the Enemy Twitter feed now, 20 minutes ago. Battlefield 2042 will be available on both Steam and the Epic Game Store for PC players. Oh, great. Thanks, New Musical Express.
I know, and you know, you've just summed it up there. You know, I remember it starting when I was still actively working for Enemy, when I did a shoot with Haim or Haim or whatever they're called.
Yeah.
And I saw on the Enemy TV, they did an interview, and one of the first questions literally was, what's your favourite sweet?
Oh dear, oh dear. Yeah, not, what do you think about this, you know, Tory government ruining the country, or, you know, get something.
And the thing is, they're intelligent women. You know, they are really intelligent. They're really, you know, they're really engaged. So to dumb it down like that is just like so appalling. I mean, that's one of the reasons, you know, where, hopefully this will happen, right? I don't know if you know, but about 20 years ago, I did a somewhat haphazard exhibition called Future Legends, where I wanted to photograph like a survey of British bands at the time. And although I'm enjoying doing this stuff, you know, the retrospective stuff a little bit, I basically want to do an updated version of that. So I want to do, you know, the 50 best bands in Britain, in my opinion, at the moment, and make an exhibition out of that. And even though obviously people won't know half the bands, you know, I think, you know, I'm not a journalist, but in the writer sense, but I just like the idea of my, you know, me saying, look, this is what I think, you need to fucking listen to these bands.
And
there needs to be more of that. It really does.
Yeah. I know Debbie Turner, who's now Debbie Ellis in Manchester, you know, who was in the band Sister Lovers, that basically she was mates with McGee, and that's how the whole McGee go into.
Yeah.
So she's a freelance photographer and does stuff with, you know, does the photography and also does promo for bands, mainly in Manchester. Like there's a girl band called Witch Fever in Manchester and things like that. You know, incredible group, and, you know, and look amazing, and have this incredible, you know, look to them, and you know, Debbie's done some amazing shots of them. But then, you know, you can imagine them looking incredible on the front of like the Enemy or Q or anything like that. But it's just
But you're exactly right, and this is why I want to do this project, because it's partly to show the value again of music photography, because it's completely devalued now, and I don't mean financially. I mean the ability of a strong image to you know, engage you, you know, to get people excited about something. That's one thing I'd like to do. And then, but also to show that there are bands out there that don't have a billion Spotify listeners, you know, but they're still fucking great, and you should check them out, you know. And it'll be a small drop in a big ocean, but I just think it's worth doing. And for me, anyway, I really love new bands. Like, it's the most exciting time to be around a band is when they're just starting out.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose the buzz is around them, and they're excited to be photographed and stuff as well. So,
well, that's the thing, you know. When I remember going out on tour with the Vaccines, the first tour, for their first UK tour, and it was so much fun. Not, you know, it's not because the people are doing drugs or anything like that. They're just, you know, every town they go to, they want to have a look around. You know, they're cracking off each other, you know, having fun. And then I went out on like their third UK tour. And whilst I'm not saying they hated each other by any means, but they were in like separate dressing rooms and not hanging out together. And, it, you know, it's not quite the same.
No, absolutely. So that's, So what's the plan for that? I mean, is it just a sort of an idea at the moment, or is there anything concrete about that, Roger?
It's an idea at the moment. I've got a few exhibitions coming up with retrospective stuff. So what I'm hoping to do is, along the way, set something in stone with this. I mean, I'm going to start shooting pretty soon for this new bands thing. I've got, you know, a few bands in mind already, and I'm asking friends to sort of chuck me their recommendations as well. So, you know, by all means, stick a few names my way. Cool. I think it's the best way to discover new music, you know.
Well, there you go. I mean, it's funny because the mainstream media is not kind of breaking new bands at all, really. So, you know, a pal of ours who runs a Twitter page called Brits and Pieces, there's done a couple of compilations of new bands on CD, and has actually got it into the charts. And Lamac played a couple of them on Six Music. And it's like, you know, because no one else is doing it. You know, no, if you're not going to get, I mean, I've ended up listening to quite a lot of Radio 1 because I've got like young kids, and Radio 1 is literally like singer-songwriters that sound like Billie Eilish, male singer-songwriters like Lewis Capaldi and Tom Grennan, and then they're doing kind of tracks with pop acts and dance acts, or grime and hip-hop. And that's fine. If that's what you're into, great. You know, and it must be an amazing time. Like we talked about, you know, the mid-90s was for bands. I mean, if you're a UK grime fan, UK hip hop fan now, you're having your Britpop moment, you know, because every other track on the radio is like Heady One or Stormzy or whatever. But there just isn't now. Like, well, okay, well, in the past, that music would have been on One Extra. Well, where's the One Extra for rock and roll music, you know? and there isn't one. And so hence, you know, you do have these sort of smaller,
but even for grime and hip hop, there's not that much. There's no great amount of telly. Radio, yes, much better supported, and rightly so. But there's still, you know, music. The visual side of music is devalued. Obviously, gaming is more popular than anything at the moment, you know, and will remain so. But there's no reason why other things can't exist in tandem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But yeah, so I like that. So if people want to get in touch with you, Roger, so it's, you are what, at Roger Sargo, S-A-R-G-O on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah. That's probably the easiest to message on, because I think Instagram, you have to approve messages, which I never seem to manage to do. I think my Twitter is at Roger Sargo.
And if people look at that, I mean, just having a scroll down it now, there's a great shot of cast there looking fun. I love this shot of Eminem.
Put some more up of that. That was it was fun. It was really early on.
Yeah, 1999. I love the whether it's a fisheye lens. I'm not an expert, but
it is. It's very super fisheye, very close again.
That's just amazing. I mean, how was he to deal with?
He was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. He's totally game for anything. Like, his security weren't happy about doing this shot. He'd just come off stage, and I said, look, can we put you against this wall, and then we'll call some fans over and scoot. Like, no fucking way. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And then, so that's the last shot before the fence fell down.
No way.
Yeah. And I got told off for that.
Well, it was worth it, mate, because that's an incredible shot. I remember seeing that. I remember that one. It's the first time I've seen it for a long time. And I just think, oh, that is just such a great shot, isn't it? I get a clean shave, babe, go to a rave, die from an overdose and dig myself up out of my grave. My middle finger won't go down, how do I wave? And this is how I'm supposed to teach kids how to behave. Now follow me and do exactly what you see. Don't you wanna grow up to be just like me? I slap women and each room's an OD. Now don't you wanna grow up to be just like me? Me and Marcus Allen went over to see Nicole. When we heard a knock at the door, must have been Ron Gold. Jump behind the door, put the orgy on hold. Kill them both and smear blood on a white Bronco. We did my it. Mind won't work if my spine don't jerk. I slap Garth Brooks out of his limestone shirt. I'm not a player, just an ill rhyme sayer that'll spray an aerosol can up at the ozone layer. Are there any other shots before I let you go? Any other shots that sort of jump out? I mean, I'm just having a look now. That's a beautiful shot of Amy Winehouse for Q Magazine.
That's the funny thing is, like, that Amy shot, I really only looked at it at that session a week or so ago. There's going to be a lot of stuff I'll find now that I didn't even realise was any good at the time. Like that Nirvana stuff that I did, I've never really done anything with them. I've never really got them out. But because of what happened since, they take on a certain gravity, don't they?
Yeah.
I'm going to be putting my Zootons pictures up soon, which I'm quite proud of, because we got them painted, like skin painted in different colours. It was quite an epic feat to do. But I don't know, really. I'm kind of busking it a little bit with what I'm putting up. So there's going to be a lot of... I did that session I did, the last NME session that I did with Oasis. I'm going to put a lot more stuff from that up, because people have only ever seen the group shot, which the band bought off me to use as a promo shot. So you'll have seen it on there, you know, with their stuff. But yeah, there's loads of other shots from that of like Liam and Andy as a pair, because is it Liam and Andy or Liam and no Liam and Alan as a pair, and then Noel and Andy, which no one was that interesting in because it's the wrong pairings, but they're quite funny pictures, so I'll definitely put some up.
Oh well, that'd be amazing, mate. It'd be great to see. And is there a plan? I mean, every photographer appears to be doing books at the moment of Oasis. Kevin Cummings has done one, and Jill's got the Nebworth book coming out, and there's been Simon Halfon's just done his cover to cover book. Are you planning any books?
Oasis books. I don't know if I've got enough. I've got enough for a sort of pamphlet.
Roger Sargent Oasis pamphlet coming soon.
Yeah.
Pre-order now.
No, I mean, I've got a fair amount, but I think it would be stretching the point a little bit, maybe. But I'd love to do some kind of, I hate saying Britpop book, but some kind of British music book, because I didn't just do Britpop, obviously. I've done British music ever since as well. So I'd like to do something that maybe spans right up until, I don't know, 2010. Because there are a lot of good bands around. But the next book's definitely going to be a Libertines book next year.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that. So the Libertines, you've got a digital exhibition coming up on Libertines.
Yeah, we planned it as a digital because we weren't sure when galleries were going to be opening again. So the first one is just quite a small virtual exhibition. And it's with Stat Galleries, and they do it really well. It's not just a matter of just like a gallery online like you'd see on your Twitter feed or whatever. It's done quite well, and there's going to be... someone's going to interview me and talk about all the pictures as well. So when you click on a picture, you'll get me talking about the picture. Still got to do that here, though. and then we're going to sort of test the water in terms of when we go physical. But he wants to do the Snap want to do a kind of British music one next. And I was in talks with British Music Experience in Liverpool about maybe putting an exhibition there as well. So what I'd quite like to do is tour some of the stuff around, various cities. So, you know, anyone listening that wants to do something like that, do get in touch.
Fantastic. Oh, that's great. And well, look, I'll let you go, but we always sort of end these with if there's a, you know, I'll be dropping in music clips throughout. Is there a particular Oasis song that means a lot to you, or that you like?
There's loads, but and it's, it may sound a bit weird, but it's something that funny enough, I've been thinking about a lot recently. But I used to DJ in the garage in London in the sort of the early to mid 90s. And when Kurt Cobain died, we used to play Take Me Away, you know, the B-side song.
Yeah.
It's just not. And that for me still, I listen to it again and it still kind of brings the tears up because it's such a beautiful song. So I think, yeah, I love lots of Oasis songs, but that's got a particularly special memory for me.
That's interesting. When you say you played it at the garage, do you mean you played it out?
Yeah, we used to play out with it. It was when Kurt died. It just seemed really fitting for some reason, and just had everyone in tears.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, yeah, it's a great song. And also, I mean, this is, you know, I wasn't that onto Oasis early enough, really, but I know talking to a lot of people that, you know, went out and bought Supersonic, the single, and then you've flick it on and then you're expecting this, you know the B-sides to all sound like Supersonic, like most bands' B-sides sound exactly the same as the A-sides. Yeah. And then you've got this beautiful acoustic tune with a completely different singer. So you're like, yeah, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
It is amazing, really, that they straight away from day one were willing to sort of showcase this other side to them. Amazing, really.
Yeah, because there are few songs that people accused them of wasting by putting on B-sides, weren't there?
Yeah.
Columbia was one of them, wasn't it? But yeah, that was the great thing about them. If you bought a 12-inch or whatever, you got really good songs.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, well, look, we'll finish with a bit of Take Me Away. But Roger, and then so obviously if people want to look you up, then it's at Roger Sargio on Twitter.
Yeah.
And yeah, we look forward to seeing the Libertines exhibition and the other stuff you've got coming up.
Nice one. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, brilliant. Thanks, Roger. All the best.
Nice one. Take care.
Just when it falls apart and when it's time to start, will you sit down here for another day? And when it's time to be all the things that we are wishing away for another day, 'cause me and my soul, we know where we're going. We're going where the grass is free and the air is clean and the good times are growing. So take me away just for today, 'cause I'm sad here on my own. I'd like to be under the sea, but I probably need a phone.
All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview. Make sure you're checking out Roger on his social media, and and check out that exhibition for the Libertines when that comes up. Should be some really, really good stuff. So all that remains for me to say is thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast, and most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it means a lot. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, and over there, we post the episodes early. We post bonus stuff. Plus, you can get access to the Discord as well, where we have a grand old time over there. Do please make sure you follow me on social media at Oasis Podcast on Twitter and Facebook, and Oasis Pod on Instagram. You can always email me, oasispod@gmail.com. And if you can, review on iTunes or other sites like that. And why not tell a friend? Why not mention it on Facebook in an Oasis group or something like that? It's always, always appreciated, any support you can give us. All right, we'll be back soon. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.